Welcome to Bruderhof Radio. I'm your host, Andrew Zimmerman. This week, a look past the year 2000 and into the next century. What can we expect? How will our lives be affected? The news media is filled with dire predictions of terrorism, global warming, economic depression, and the comeback of widespread infectious disease. On the other hand, the stock market continues to surge above 10,000. How is the average citizen to differentiate between these conflicting outlooks? To answer these questions, Bruderhof Radio's Ben Wright spoke with Gerald Salenti, director of the Trends Research Institute in Rhinebeck, New York, and author of the book Trends 2000. For more than a decade, Salenti has tracked global trends and successfully forecast a growing list of headlines, including the demise of the Soviet Union, the 1997 Asian currency crisis, and increasing corporate mergers and workforce downsizing. But while he is primarily known as a prophet for hire by Fortune 500 companies, it is his continuous re-examination of the present that adds relevance to his commentary.
In the book Trends 2000, you talk quite a bit about biotechnology. In 1997, I think it was February, Dr. Ian Wilmot at the Rosalind Institute in the United Kingdom was announcing the cloning of Dolly. And we haven't heard a whole lot about cloning since then. It created a bit of a stir. Clinton came out, tried to have a moratorium on cloning. There was a bit of back and forth with some European nations. What has been going on, and what does the future look like in biotechnology?
Well, there have been more cloning successes, and regardless of, and we're not taking an ideological viewpoint, but regardless of the ideologies or beliefs, moral issues, there's not going to be any stopping it. And we're going to see in a very few years, if it hasn't happened already and we don't even know about it, there's going to be human cloning. And there's going to be stem cell manipulation and more biotechnological advances. It's inevitable. It's going to happen. No one could tell what the implications are going to be, neither short-term, near-term, or long-term.
So because of the commercial value of this kind of technology, it's inevitable?
Well, whether it's the commercial value, the perceived commercial value, or just the mentality of the scientific community, it's going to be pushed forward.
Who is going to be using this technology, especially if it's made illegal, assuming that there's some kind of market for it? And what are the implications of that going to be in society?
Well, when you look at the cloning, for instance, they love to come out with the lines of, oh, it will provide an ability to develop strains of cattle and poultry that are resistant to different diseases, and we'll be able to feed the world. You know, they're always going to feed the world. There's enough product out there right now to feed the world. Commodity prices are at 20-year lows, whether livestock or wheat or soybeans. And there's a glut of product. So the rationale to develop more and cheaper product really doesn't cut either way. What it does is it can only assure that the small farmer trying to compete in a mass market will be pushed out.
Mm-hmm.
So what it does, it sets the stage for even larger mass production capabilities.
I think in many areas, including perhaps biotechnology, we're beginning to see a widening gap between the rich and the poor, the enfranchised and the disenfranchised. How does this relate to biotechnology, and what kind of moral issues does that?
Well, the moral issues with biotechnology on the human level, of course, are, you know, should we be cloning people, or we? Should scientists be cloning people? And that answer, the debate really isn't going to count because there's no stopping it.
Mm-hmm.
So it becomes really a moot issue. And again, no one knows what the implications are going to be. So, you know, as we look in the 21st century, it's important to look at these issues because it really sets the stage for what lies ahead, in terms that it's going to become increasingly apparent that what existed in the past 2,000 years, life and how it was lived, is going to be very different from the next 2,000 years. And that the old world ways of doing things will not cross the millennial divide. So, for instance, you could go back to World War II. Go to any of the developed nations in World War II around that time, and you could have seen in agrarian societies links to the distant past, the way they were farming, you know, medieval things, you know, making the way they made their, grew their food and harvested it. Those changes, those ways of life don't exist anymore. And then when you look at cloning, genetic engineering, stem cell manipulation, artificial intelligence, space travel, you can see that the future is by definition foreseeably unforeseeable. We're going into uncharted territory here. The rule book has not been written yet.
Mm-hmm. Many of these things sound, at least on the outside, like good things. You may be optimistic about the future in some respects, but how are we doing on some of the other larger issues of the environment and population? Are we, as many scientists saying, in the middle of a mass extinction? And particularly with the environment, how much progress have we actually made?
Well, the environment has been, it really hasn't progressed much at all. There's a lot of talk. You know, like, for instance, you hear these words, you know, the EPA Superfund. Well, I know that as about 2 years ago, about $17 billion between the time the Superfund was created in the 1970s to about 1996 had been spent.
Mm-hmm.
Most of that went to legal fees. So let's be generous and say $8 billion was spent to clean up the environment, these Superfund sites, and there are thousands of them. Just look about a week ago, and you'll see that President Clinton asked for $6 billion to wage the war against Yugoslavia, and Congress said, hey, wait a minute, $6 billion, how about $12 billion? So when you look at reality and oppose it to rhetoric, you can see that very little gains have been made environmentally. And then when you look at society, they talk a green game, but then they go out and buy these monstrous sport utility vehicles that are gas guzzlers and environmental polluters. So, you know, we talk a lot about the environment, but not that much has been done. The good news is that that industries cannot blatantly disregard the environment as they used to in the past.
Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about your mentioning of the conflict in Kosovo. What kind of environmental implications does that specific situation have? We know that there's a military-industrial complex in this country, and it seems to be making a great deal of money off the current conflict. But what about the damage to the environment? Is there use of depleted uranium weapons? And what are the implications to the world of this conflict?
Well, it's interesting that you call it a conflict. When does war become war? And I'm not criticizing you. That's the word that's being used everywhere, conflict in Kosovo. I believe to the people that are being bombed or the refugees, they would consider it war. The war has been devastating to Yugoslavia. The vast amount of petroleum depots that have been bombed, the massive pollution that has taken place in the Danube and throughout Yugoslavia is incalculable. It is going to be far-reaching, and it's going to be something that also is an indicator of how little regard there is for the environment when the military becomes involved in an operation. So I don't think in total the Kosovo war is going to cause massive environmental problems outside the region, but inside the region, the pollution and devastation is massive.
what is going to be the outcome of this war, and how long is it going to drag on?
If you open my book, Trends 2000, up, and remember that was written in 1995, I began to write it. I have a line on in page 4, you wake up, you're in the 21st century, and you're looking back. And I have a sentence that says, there's saber-rattling in Germany as the war in the Balkans spills over its borders. To say back then that Germany, you know, of all countries, would be bombing a sovereign nation in 1995, people thought we were lunatics. The Yugoslav war will end up as all foreign conflicts that the United States involves itself in end up since World War II. And that is terrible loss of life, extreme cost to the American taxpayer, devastation to the people that have been the victims on both sides, and in the end, they will call it peace with honor. So Yugoslavia will remain Yugoslavia. People will be displaced as they are already from their homes. And life will go on at a very high cost.
Who will benefit?
No one. There is no benefit. The benefit. Look what happened when they began this war. The immediate objective was to stabilize the situation. By even the most unobjective of observers, everyone would agree that the NATO bombings have made a bad situation worse. What was a refugee trickle has turned into a refugee flood, not to mention the estimated $40 billion worth of damage that has happened in Yugoslavia. And something else that, by the way, no one seems to be willing to talk about. If a sovereign nation bombs another sovereign nation, does the nation that has been bombed have the right to bomb the nations that bombed it? In other words, at some point, the United States policy of bombing sovereign nations is going to result in retaliation. The hypocrites will call it terrorism. The victims will call it war.
Do you think that we're going to be seeing ground troops in the future?
No. You know, I'm fascinated with that, by the way. I love to watch these talk shows, and I see these middle-aged people talking about, you know, what we have to do, and we have to get tough. And a matter of fact, I just saw a full-page ad or a half-page ad in the New York Times signed by such people as Geraldine Ferraro, et cetera, talking about the need for ground troops. And when they say we, I think they're misusing that word, because most of these middle-aged people don't look like they're in good enough shape to run up a flight of stairs, let alone run through a combat zone with full battle gear. So when they're saying we, I don't think they're including themselves, and I know that they're not including their children, you know, the Chelsea Clintons and the young Ferraros, etc., you know, the Harvard, Stanford, and Yale boys and girls. They don't mean those we's. So I think the we's that they're talking about are like the Gonzaleses and the Rodriguez's and the Washingtons and the Wilsons. You know, just for the same reason why the war in Vietnam came finally to a halt, when all of a sudden the ethnic people that were really fighting that war started to rebel in the fields. So you're not going to see it happen. There's not a good enough cause for it to happen.
You're listening to Gerald Celente of the Trends Research Institute on Bruderhof Radio.
You mentioned terrorism in your book, Trends 2000, and I think you predicted a 1993 increase in domestic terrorism. What is the cause of this kind of terrorism, and isn't it connected to United States imperialist actions in the foreign world?
Well, let's look at it like this. The Gulf War began in 1990. In 1993, in February, virtually 1992, actually, you know, just a month after 1993 began, all of a sudden the World Trade Center is bombed. Do you think that was retaliation for the Gulf War, the first major terrorist activity in American soil? As we speak, the United States continues on a virtually a daily basis bombing Iraq. In the summer of 1998, President Clinton chose to bomb the Sudan and Afghanistan. And now, as we know, the targets in the Sudan, a supposed military complex that produced weapons of mass destruction, was no more than a pharmaceutical plant. And they were never making those weapons of mass destruction that were initially reported, biological warfare weapons. And there's going to be a point of more retaliation. Anytime a nation gets involved in another nation's conflict and takes a side within that nation, you can be assured that they've alienated another side. That's why this war that's going on now is against everything that the framers of the Constitution so wisely built into it, not to become involved in other nations' conflicts if our national security interests were not endangered. And certainly, the Kosovo War was not endangering U.S. national interests. And if it was a morality issue, it's also a hypocrisy issue. Because, number one, nothing is black and white, except when it comes to United States involvement in African nations' problems, then it is definitely a black and white issue, as we saw with Rwanda, what's going on in Ethiopia, the Congo, etc. And basically that is, if a country is black, then the United States finds no interest in any strategic sense to get involved in it. And another interesting thing, as this Yugoslav war continues to evolve, it's important to note that 95% of the Greek people of Greece are against this war. The Russians are against the war. The Italians, the majority, are now against the war. The Chinese are against the war. Are all these people wrong, or are there two sides to this story? Or should the United States be bombing the Russians, the Chinese, the Greeks, and the Italians because they don't see eye to eye with NATO's policy? And by the way, another level of hypocrisy that I see going on is all this talk about, you know, to quote President Clinton, we have to teach our children to solve conflicts with words and not weapons. Well, as I pointed out, President Clinton, since 1993, has been bombing sovereign nations. Madeleine Albright said, quote, the only thing that Slobodan Milosevic understands is force. And believe me, I'm in the camp of those who believe that Slobodan Milosevic is a terrible dictator who has done terrible things to that country. Mm-hmm. But if you're going to build on a premise that the only way you can solve conflicts is with force, don't be hypocritical and expect other people not to solve their conflicts with force. In my book, Trends 2000, I wrote, this is on page 149, in 1995, President Clinton stated, quote, there is no right to resort to violence when you don't get your way. There is no right to kill people. Those who claim such rights are wrong and un-American. Well, the United States is killing innocent people. And they love to come out with the line after they bomb innocent people and kill them that it's nobody's fault but either Slobodan Milosevic himself or Saddam Hussein. I mean, that's twisted logic. That's like killing somebody and saying that, you know, the devil made me do it. Mm-hmm. So the point that I'm making is that until there is moral and spiritual leadership coming from the hierarchies of society, and by the way, there is also a deafening silence coming from the religious sectors today relative to this war, there will be violence throughout society unless violence at the top of society begins to stop.
Has democracy won out in the world? We know that with the crumbling of the USSR and the collapse of many socialist governments. In this hemisphere, we only have remaining Cuba. And has democracy won out, and has it sort of won the experiment in the world?
We have not yet. We have lost the democracy and continue to lose democracy in the United States. It's a myth that we have a free electoral system in the sense that all you have to do is turn on the evening news each night and you hear about Republicans and Democrats. They keep feeding us with a myth of bipartisan agreements. Well, we're a multicultural society. Bi means two. So anytime the two people get together and make an agreement, that means the rest of our needs have been satisfied. Anybody that wants to run in a major election knows that they're virtually shut out of the electoral process unless they're funneled money from special interests, those people that want to buy their way into power. We also see the loss of democracy as the United States unilaterally, from the top, decided to wage a war against the sovereign nation, going against everything that our Constitution stands for. And I'm also taken by the hypocrisy whereby when the issue of whether or not oral sex was an impeachable offense was so hotly debated on the TV news that the war against Yugoslavia began only with sound bites. I heard Chris Matthews, the host of Hardball, who spent a year and a plus talking about Monica Lewinsky and Bill Clinton, say, "You know, I didn't even know where Kosovo was." Of course he didn't, because he was too busy talking about these other more important issues. The point being is that democracy is lost in this country. The media is controlled by a very small amount of special interests. There is no debate about a war. We've seen the anchors and the morning guests, the morning hosts of these shows appear at every Pentagon public relations photo opportunity, standing on aircraft carriers, watching planes taking off. The point being, there is no debate. The war is being waged illegally against our Constitution, and the people have not have any say, did not have any say in it. So I would argue that democracy is even living up to its fullest right now, particularly since two parties and a group of special interests are virtually in control of the government. It's a soundbite war. I'll give you another example of the blatant propaganda. The United States bombs innocent people. It comes out in the news, and the spokespeople from the State Department and NATO say, "Oh, don't believe that. You can't believe any of the lies coming out of Serbia." Remember when they bombed the convoy of innocent people and last week bombed people that were sleeping near a farm. The next day they come out and say, "Well, NATO was involved in that area, but there was also Serb shelling." The third day they come out and they say, "Well, we did bomb the people, but it was a legitimate military target. It was a command post." What command post? Did you see this thing? It was a farm. But number four is that they say they were using the people as human shields. In other words, what they do is they muddy the issue. Most of the public does not have the time to stay informed on each step of the event. So they hear from NATO spokesmen and from the Pentagon and from the State Department that the Serbs are a liar. It was probably the Serbs that killed them in the first place, and they're blaming NATO unjustly. So the propaganda war on both sides is equally appalling.
I want to ask about the future of war in the middle of all this war. Are we eventually going to realize that it's better to talk than shoot? Or is war going to be as much a part of the next century as it was of this century?
I would believe that as long as the military-industrial complex continues to exert such enormous pressure over the American economy, that war will be the first choice in solving any kind of conflict. I'd like to point out that there used to be a thing that they talked about after the Cold War, at the end of the Cold War, they used to talk about a peace dividend. Well, what happened to the peace dividend? The United States taxpayer is still shelling out some $270 billion to keep the military wheels greased.
Mm-hmm.
I love the quote, by the way, from the greatest general of the 20th century, arguably Dwight D. Eisenhower, who said, quote, "Every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies in the final sense a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and not clothed. The world in arms is not spending money alone. It's spending the sweat of laborers, the genius of scientists, and the hopes of its children." So the message is clear. He warned the nation, this is a general warning the nation, that the military-industrial complex is taking over the country. And indeed it has. You just saw what happened with President Clinton asking for $6 billion to wage his war against Yugoslavia, and Congress saying, no, you need $12 billion, here you go. And now they just also came up with about a $30 billion budget for military intelligence. So, until the people want something different, that's what we'll continue to have.
Thanks for listening to Bruderhof Radio. Today's guest was Gerald Celente, director of the Trends Research Institute in Rhinebeck, New York. Bruderhof Radio, which is produced by Andrew Zimmerman, is a project of the Bruderhof Communities, a communal movement based on Christ's Sermon on the Mount. In particular, the teachings concerning brotherly love and love of enemies, mutual service, nonviolence, and the refusal to bear arms. Instead of holding assets or property, we share everything in common, and each member gives his or her talents, time, and effort wherever they are needed. To obtain more information about Bruderhof Radio or the Bruderhof Communities, call 914-658-8351 or write to Woodcrest Bruderhof, Rifton, New York, 12471.